So ever since the brutal attack on Israel by Hamas last week, I've been thinking and thinking and thinking about what it is to be Jewish. And I was talking to my wife about growing up in a tiny middle of nowhere town, one of a handful of Jewish families, and being asked if we grew horns, and having pennies thrown at us, and having our neighbor talk about people Jewing you down, and having to sing about Christ's birth in school holiday concerts, and oftentimes being left out of community events. And you knew why you were being left out, even if it was sort of unsaid. And I know I can't really complain. I've lived a charmed life here in America, and I also know the Middle East is complicated and far beyond my brain power. But I just want people to understand that being Jewish, it matters. It's not just a religion. It's certainly not just the holidays. It's a people. It's my people. My name is Jeff Perlman. I'm the New York Times bestselling author of 10 books and the host of Two Writers, Sing and Yang, the podcast where one writer, me, talks writing with another writer every single week. And today's guest is Russ Bankston, the former Slam Magazine editor and author of the new book, A History of Basketball in 15 Sneakers. This is episode number 333. Let's sing some Yang.
Dad, your podcast sucks and you're culturally irrelevant.
All right, Russ. First of all, it's jarring seeing you wearing glasses, but more importantly, I think you were the fifth ever guest on this podcast. So years and years ago, you did the fifth episode ever of Two Writers, Sling and Yang. And I just want to say, carrying over from that, because I'm sure everyone listening to this is like, whoa, I just listened to the fifth episode from 2017. I'm sorry about the snake. I still hold some guilt about the snake.
If I close my eyes, I can still smell the snake. That was an unfortunate episode in the East 70s.
For people listening real quick, Russ and I go way back. We attended the University of Delaware together. We worked on the student newspaper, The Review, together. And then we were roommates when Russ was the editor of Slam and I was working at Sports Illustrated in the mid to late 1990s. And we shared an apartment above Stanley Chen's Chinese restaurant,
which I hope is still there. I haven't been up to that part of the city in like since we lived there, basically.
Yeah, not there. It was a 4 or 3 floor walk up. Two studios merged together. So we had two bathrooms, one kitchen. It was the weirdest apartment. We had mice. We had a break in.
Super strange apartment. It was like a step up to get into your apartment. It was like an airlock.
Yeah.
How many episodes have there been? If I was the fifth one, what are we up to now? What's this one?
This will probably be number 334.
Holy God. That's pretty impressive, Jeff.
You know, it's even more impressive, and that makes me feel sad. I actually remember being with you and my old college roommate, Dan Monahan, and we watched the NCAA championship, and this is how old we are. Keith Van Horn was playing for Utah. Keith Van Horn has probably been retired from the NBA for 15 years now.
RIP Rick Majerus.
Big ups, Rick.
Talk about being old and NCAA tournament. I remember covering a town board meeting for the Oxford Tribune, circulation 1200, the night Michigan played North Carolina in the championship game. And people started leaving early. And I was so mad because I was like 45 minutes from home, knowing that I would miss like most of that game, and had to drive my old station wagon home, like probably over the speed limit to just catch the end of it. Shout out to the Fab Five.
I mean, how about the fact that the Fab Five are now almost the wheelchair five? Like they're all. So again, we have known each other for many moons, and you are the author of a new book called A History of Basketball in 15 Sneakers. This is a really nerdy podcast. It tends to be a nerdy podcast. And we spoke multiple times during the process of you writing this book.
Yeah.
And it felt to me like this was torture for you. It felt to me like doing this book was an exercise in self-mutilation, that it was really, and books are that way, that it was really hard. You suffered personal tragedy during the course of this book.
Yeah.
Being a book is hard. It's a beast. Am I misreading that?
No, you're not. It was a struggle. And like, you know, I guess like there's certain aspects of it that no matter who you talk to, you really can't figure out until you do it. You know, like I talked to you obviously a lot about it. When the proposal was bought, I actually reached out via DM to Susan Orlean because she follows me on Twitter to be like, yo, like I have to write this nonfiction book now. Like, what do I do? And people were very helpful as far as the mechanics of it. You know, like you should have folders. You should reach out to everyone you can think of. And I think what made it super difficult and what was the hardest part for me is like, it's such a long process, you know, like you have so much time to like really like worry about every aspect of it and be like, should I be doing more? Should I have done less? Should I like, and just all those things that I think would be issues when you're writing a magazine piece, like you don't really have time. Cause I mean, even if you're writing a long magazine piece, you still have to get it done in like a month or maybe 2 months or whatever it is. The idea of spending years on one thing is just really difficult. And I was telling someone else the other day, like another thing that's tough is, you know, people ask about what do you regret leaving out? And it's like, man, the whole process of writing a book is leaving out. You know what I mean? And I think you would know what I mean because you've done this now a bunch of times. Like when you first sit down to work on it, it's like, okay, I can choose from anything and I can write anything I want. And I think like it's freeing, but it's also terrifying because it's like from the moment you start, you're cutting stuff. You're like, okay, I'm going to tell this one particular story. Well, that means there's an infinite number of other ones I can't tell. I tell people the most important word in the title of my book is A, because it's a history of basketball. It's not the history of basketball. In order for me to write the history of basketball, even just in 15 sneakers, it would have to be like 50,000 pages. So like from the beginning, you're figuring out like what parts you can't use.
My kid loves sneakers. A million of his friends love sneakers. You obviously have a longtime love of sneakers.
Yeah.
I pretty much go to Nordstrom Rack and buy whatever sneakers fit my feet. Like, I don't care. I just don't care. It's not that I dislike sneakers, but it's time to play basketball. I need new shoes. I go, I get a pair of whatever. The old Kyries are 50% off and they're only $40.
Right.
How do you explain this thing that people have for sneakers in the same way when I was a kid, maybe I had for baseball cards or someone has for automobiles or whatever? What is it about sneakers?
And this is something I thought about a lot while writing the book, even though it had nothing to do with the actual book's premise. But retro really threw things into like, should I say a tizzy? Does that make me seem old?
Yes.
It really messed things up because like, if you talk about other things like that, if you talk about baseball cards to me, that was just about going to the local stationery store and looking at all the cellophane rack packs and trying to find a player you liked or a player from the team you liked on the front or the back and buying that pack and hopefully hitting on players you liked. Now cards are like virtually unrecognizable, I think, to like me as a kid, where it's like, there's 80 different rookie cards of whoever this player is. There's one of a kind, like autograph cards or cards with pieces of a jersey in it. Like it's become this monster that is almost unrecognizable to the idea of just like going out and buying the new tops, spending 79 cents on a wax pack and like throwing the gum away. And sneakers, I think like when I grew up and when we grew up, it was simple, right? Like you wanted the new Air Jordan every year or the new whatever every year, because like that was the cool shoe. The cool shoe was the new top of the line sort of expensive thing that you saw commercials about. And every year a new one would come out. And even if you didn't love it, you probably wanted it just because of what it was. And sneakers now, with retro and with limited editions and with collaborations and all this other stuff, it's like the new Air Jordan comes out and hardly anyone cares because all the old Air Jordans are still available and are being made available. Like Jordan Brand releases more shoes now in a week than they used to in a year. And I think people like our age, and I'm using our loosely, I'm saying like probably 40s to 50s, even probably to 60 if people were into it when they were older. You know, they grew up with the way marketing worked and like, especially Nike, like their ads and Jordan ads and whatever else, and like really wanting this stuff, but you would only get like a pair or two a year, if that. And all of a sudden, like we hit the age where like we were making real money and retro happened, and it's like all of a sudden there's this flood of product of stuff you wanted or stuff you had being made available again. And it's like all this pent up desire like ended up being pushed into that, like, oh my God, I can just buy everything. And I think there's a lot of people who still have that outlet and still want that and still go out and buy things they didn't have or buy things they had that they want to have again. And I think there's another group that I consider myself part of where I'm like, wait a minute, hold on, enough of this. Like, this is insane. I can't do this anymore. And it's funny you bring up Nordstrom Rack. Like, I haven't bought sneakers there, but I go to like Burlington and look there, mm-hmm. you know, like my sort of mantra now with retro in particular is like, if I had it back then I already had it and I don't need it. And if I didn't have it back then, well, I somehow survived not having it. So I guess I never needed it at all.
Yeah.
And I've kind of intentionally limited my scope to where I just want to get the new stuff now. Like if I want a pair of shoes to wear, I would rather wear like a new performance basketball shoe casually, because that's how all this desirable stuff became desirable. That's the way we wore it back then. So instead of chasing the old product, I'd rather chase like the old feeling. And that's where the old feeling came from.
It is interesting because as an example, like Nas, the rapper, has come out with, I think, three albums this year, which you can do now because you don't have to mm-hmm. worry about, you know, the production is much easier and you're not literally having to wait 6 months for an album to be pressed and put out and blah, 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 or CD to be pressed. And for my son who loves Nas, and I love Nas too, but it's great. But to me, there's a little bit of, oh, another Nas album. He just came out with one 3 months ago. And I wonder if, you know, at all that people are missing, quote unquote, young people are missing the joy of what it was to anticipate when things are so accessible now.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's missing from the sneaker world and it's missing with music and movies and whatever else. Cause I think back then, like there was obviously a, what's the phrase I'm looking for? Like there were trade-offs. You had to make a lot of trade-offs, right? Like if you went to Sam Goody, which to our younger listeners was a store that sold music, to buy a record, you had to choose. Like if I buy the new, and I'm going to be
going
back to my heavy metal self. If I buy the new Iron Maiden record, that means I can't buy the new Judas Priest record for months, maybe. You had to sit there and look and be like, damn, like, which one do I really want? Which one do I want first?
I get you're trying to show off here, but your decision was really, do I buy Tiffany or Debbie Gibson?
Okay, or that. But you know what I mean? Like that $13 or $15 or whatever, like you had to make sure you bought what you really wanted and like you would listen to the whole thing, whether you really liked it or not, because like you spent that money. And now with streaming, it's like, you just listen to everything. Yeah. Oh, new stuff's out. Let me just go to the tab of new music and like blow through all this stuff. So like, it does kind of lose some of its, I don't know, some of its importance. And with sneakers, and I think part of why, you know, I wanted to write a book like this is, you know, that's been lost too. And context is something that like completely falls out. And in part, I do blame like the brands, and in part, it's just like, unfortunately, the way it is, because when you're re-releasing stuff from literally every era all the time, you can't put everything into context. Like there's no way to do it. Even if you're just putting stuff on a shelf at a store, how do you do it? You know, there's 100 basketball shoes. Like, how do you make it so it makes sense? You know, so the book for me was kind of a chance for me at least to impose a little order on something that's become completely chaotic.
One of my favorite parts of the book by far is the devotion you put into the Reebok pump. And you wrote the first pump shoe in 1989 represented a fairly direct trade-off of fit for weight. As anyone who eagerly entered a Foot Locker athlete's foot to try on the $170 shoe could attest, the pump hugged your foot like nothing else, but it was heavy. Breathability wasn't much of a consideration either. What with the TPU reinforced leather upper and industrial strength bladders wrapping around your feet. For say a 90-pound 14-year-old trying to make their junior high school team, a lighter, if less customizable shoe may have made more sense. But that first pump was essentially an experimental design pushed to market by a company that didn't want to wait. And then 2 years later, you have D. Brown winning the slam dunk contest, D. Brown of the Boston Celtics, with this pumping up his shoe beforehand. And I'm fascinated by something, and I've wondered this for years. Was the pump a gimmick? Was it just pure gimmick? Or was there something to be said for that mechanism?
I think there was something to be said for it. I think it's a little of both. You know, I think like it was something that kind of sold itself as far as like, you know, Nike Air, like when Nike Air became a see-through thing in the sole, it was something that didn't have to be explained. You could look at that and be like, oh yeah, that's probably going to be like bouncy or whatever. And the pump was kind of the same way. It's like you have this inviting little basketball on the tongue that you could squeeze and you would feel it when it happened. Like it would fit better around your foot. Was it a good idea? I think like the fact that most basketball shoes now are low cut and there's more freedom of movement means like maybe having an air cast around your shoe to play hoops in was probably a bad idea. But someone did bring up when I was talking about the idea that if you bought them as a kid and you're a size 6 and you grow to a size 7, you could probably use that pump just to like fill the extra space and get in some extra time out of a shoe instead of growing out of it in a matter of months. So I think there was some utility there too. And obviously like whatever, you know, like the proof was in, like people did play in it, you know, like I talked about it in the book that Dominique Wilkins won the dunk contest in that first pump. You know, could Dominique Wilkins have won that dunk contest wearing like cowboy boots? Probably. They did work. It's funny, like, I don't think I weighed 90 pounds when I was 14. I was probably a little heavier and I never bothered trying out for junior high basketball, but I did try a pair on back then. I actually tried them on at Herman's World of Sporting Goods. I don't know if that rings a bell for you, but, I mean, there was zero chance like that kind of money was going to get spent on a pair of shoes, but it was like a new kind of cool thing back then.
Well, you write about the Air Jordan 9s and when Jordan was playing baseball, which I remember kind of fondly, actually, the shoe is out. And he wrote, among Jordan's chosen ones were Kendall Gill in Seattle and Nick Anderson in Orlando, who had both played at Illinois. There was Anderson's Magic teammate, Anthony Penny Hardaway, Mitch Richmond in Sacramento, Latrell Sprewell in Golden State, and Jordan's former Bulls teammate, BJ Armstrong, who would go on to make his first All-Star team in 94. There was also Miami's Harold Miner, the 93 slam dunk champion as a rookie, who had been dubbed Baby Jordan while still in high school. The roster mostly featured guards in Jordan's old mold, although not with his level of region or court transcending charisma. Beyond like luck and beyond even like just he was a really good basketball player. Like you just mentioned, a ton of really, you know, good to great NBA players, none of whom inspired basketball sales in any major way, basketball shoe sales in any major way. Like they're all just, you know, no one was going out to buy a Charles Sprewell shoe. And even you mentioned Dominique, and Dominique has a shoe, but like, Dominique, as great as he was, wasn't really inspiring a shitload of people to buy shoes. In fact, neither was D. Brown, who won this. What was it about Jordan, or what is it about Jordan that just like resonated? There have been other great basketball players. There have been other basketball players who have won lots of titles. But Jordan is a singular shoe phenomenon unlike anything we've ever seen.
I mean, I think it all goes back to the Jordan 1, you know, and I think it goes back to the Jordan 1 being this like kind of new concept basically. And, you know, going away from, you know, you had half a century of a basketball shoe just being a canvas vulcanized high top, right? Like Converse was the basketball shoe forever. And then Adidas, you know, does the Superstar, you move into leather, and then the dictionary definition of basketball shifts to like a white leather high top with a logo in whatever team color it is, you know, and then you have Air Jordan come around with black and red and Jordan comes out and immediately shows he's like probably the best basketball player on the planet between the Olympics and his rookie season. And it was kind of almost a false light to all these other companies where it's like Air Jordan sold so much that other companies were like, oh my God, if we find the right player and make the right shoe, we can like take a piece of this. But it's like, yeah, but Air Jordan didn't create a vacuum as much as it filled it, and it was still there. So you weren't going to like bump it aside. You know, Jordan, I think, benefited from being first in that sense. And also back in the mid 80s, companies and even the media as it was like could sort of build myth easier. Had Jordan come up in the social media era, it's different because you can't really hide anything. It's going to be so expansive. And back then, you know, Jordan's entire like kind of mythos was built on what? Like WGN, Nike commercials, and the occasional Sports Illustrated story. You know, it was a matter of access. Like how many people were, it's not like people were going online to read the Chicago Tribune or the Sun-Times. You had very limited sources of information, and Jordan could kind of become a myth. And he was that good to come around to some of those other guys too. Like, you know, unfortunately, they didn't have the same backing and the same idea of like, yo, like Nike's entire future was sort of hinging on Jordan being successful. I don't think any of those other players you mentioned really were put in that spot. You know, Reebok was going to be okay, probably, if Dominique Wilkins didn't work out, or D Brown, and they didn't shove everything they had behind them. Obviously, like Nick Anderson, Penny Hardaway, Latrell Sprewell, those guys, like they didn't suddenly become like, okay, we're going to have Spike Lee do commercials with you. Like Michael Jordan was still the focus in selling those shoes. You know, those guys were kind of just, and you know, you hate to say it about all NBA guys, but like they were kind of placeholders. I don't know if I would say that Jordan knew for a fact he was going to come back, but you know, I don't think it ever fully left his mind that he could. You know, I don't think the idea was ever like, let's find someone who's going to be the new me. Because it's like, whoever wore it, the shoe was still called the Air Jordan. It still had a silhouette of him on the shoe. You know, I don't think any of those guys were really going to get a chance. And to go a step further, I mean, Penny Hardaway, once he got his own line, did become pretty huge. I mean, for a guy who made, I think, 2 first-team All-NBA squads and was pretty much like injured and on his way out before he even reached 30, or by the time he was 30, like he became like a larger than life figure too. But it wasn't until they really put all that marketing might behind him.
Let's say, I'm actually being serious, the first Jordans come out and they're yellow and pink, or they're purple and dark blue, or whatever. Are we still talking about Jordan as a shoe phenomenon, or did the color make a huge imprint?
I think the color made a difference. I mean, honestly, like, am I sort of more, my hypothetical is like, what if Jordan breaks his foot, you know, 10 games or whatever it was into his first season instead of his second season? You know, something like that could have blown the whole thing up, as far as I'm concerned. Like, they did do a great job of like building desire for that shoe. It's not like Nike really had anything to look back at as to this is the blueprint of how we should do it. But, you know, he started wearing the shoe in November. It didn't go on sale till April. And in that time, he became like the kind of must-watch guy in the NBA. He was in the dunk contest. He didn't win, but he came in second. He became this figure. They ran those commercials. Nike banned, you know, the NBA banned the shoe. I mean, as they banned him wearing black and red when everyone else was wearing a white-based shoe. But Nike really capitalized on that too. So, I mean, in that sense, if they come out with a yellow and pink shoe and NBA is like, yo, you can't wear that, and they do the band commercial, like maybe it does still work the same way. And if nothing else, maybe like wild colored shoes become the norm even earlier than they did. Here's something too, like that I think I really learned in this process. And I'm sure it's something you recognize too, like with your books, where we can only live forward, right? And we're trying to write something historical. And I think when you look back at stuff, it all seems very neat, right? Like I think I tried to talk about this somewhere along the line, maybe in one of the Jordan chapters, but like, if you look back at history, it looks like a series of inevitable decisions. A lot of times it seems very neat. And the only way you can really do it justice is try and put yourself back in time and look at it forward. Because like, I think about it, like even with our own personal decisions, right? Like you do something stupid and you look back and you're like, God damn it. Like, why did I do that? That's so obvious. But it's like, no, if it was so obvious at the time, you wouldn't have done it. You know what I mean? Like your brain kind of tricks itself. So I think with Air Jordan, even I had to go back and try and be like, okay, imagine being the Bulls in 1984. It seems stupid that Rod Thorne came out and was like, hey, fan base, I'm real sorry, we didn't pick a center. You know, we wanted one, but we couldn't get one. But it's like, that was the way teams thought back then. You know, like none of this seemed obvious. I think, you know, even David Falk, who, wow, I mean, you kind of need to like buckle up before ever talking to him. But, you know, even he said it, like, no one really could have looked at Michael Jordan and Nike and Air Jordan and thought like it was going to be this big, or that Michael Jordan would turn out to be, like, arguably, and I'm saying arguably for legal reasons, the best player ever, because otherwise he would have been the first pick.
Wait, I have a couple questions here. Number one, you say Michael Jordan, best player ever. Again, I hate to bring this up. You were at Delaware for Spencer Dunkley's heyday. So
this is true. This is true. I mean, you know, I can never look past the dunking Brit.
Number two, you said when you talked to David Falk, the obviously very well-known agent, you have to buckle up. What does that mean?
He was the wildest conversation for this book, because, like, I had emailed his assistant and never heard back, and, like, some other people. And late one night, my phone rings, and it was a cell phone, and, like, there was a notification on it like I'd never seen before. I don't remember what it was. It wasn't like block number or number not available. It was some crazy thing. Like, I don't even know. Like, it felt like you were getting a call from the CIA. And I picked up, and it was Falk, and he had never, like, said he was going to call me or anything. And we had this, like, sort of 2-hour conversation. I don't know. It was like a duel almost. Like, he was really throwing this stuff at me, and, like, I would overthink my answer because I was nervous, and he'd be like, no, and explain this thing. And I'd be like, yeah, but he kept coach sort of coming back, like, are you sure this is something you want to write? And it's like, David, I've been in this, like, at this confluence of sneakers, and, you know, it was almost like having to prove myself the entire time. And he would keep coming back to that, like, I'm going to charge you for this. This is like a class. But yeah, I mean, you know, he's one of those sort of through lines of what became the modern, like, sort of signature basketball business, I guess. You know, it's like from working with Donald Dell, in the early days of ProServe, which is funny because, like, you never think of ProServe being tennis, but duh. And Donald Dell was, like, an elite level tennis player and did Arthur Ashe and some of these other guys' deals, you know, and then them getting James Worthy, the biggest sneaker deal in history at the time, then Michael Jordan and Air Jordan, then Allen Iverson at Reebok and Patrick Ewing and what turned out to be the Ewing brand. And it's funny because Falk also had this sort of, I don't know, like, I think he misses sort of the Wild West aspect of being a player agent. And, like, that's not really something that came up in the book too much, but, like, you know, he would talk about, like, how much money he got Juwan Howard. And it goes back to us talking about that in the beginning, like, yo, the Fab Five are, like, wild old, like, Juwan is the coach of Michigan now. And, like, David Falk still has a point of pride in, like, Juwan Howard's $100 million contract. It's like, that was 30 years ago. Yeah. And he kind of doesn't have that same fire as far as, like, doing contracts anymore and doing that kind of work. And, you know, it's not because the money isn't insane, because obviously the money is. And, like, you'd think, like, that would be the easiest thing in the world. Obviously, he could get clients. A max deal is what, like $300 million now? Like, you get a pretty good cut out of that. But I think for Falk, it was less getting the big deal and more like getting more than someone else could. And now we're at a point where what? A new contract is just like, okay, you're a max player. You can sign for 35% of the cap. Like, that's just not fun.
That was pretty impressive. They got Juwan Howard that money.
And it was like, yeah, Juwan and Alonzo Mourning. And then they had all that, like, oh, well, you can't give Juwan $100 million and Alonzo $100 million. So Juwan ends up back in Washington.
Yeah. But then Shaq used that money really to leverage his, you know, his value. Because he's like, if these two guys are getting this kind of money, I should be getting blank. And he wants
right. And then Kevin Garnett, and then labor stoppage. And now, like, that money looks kind of quaint. You know, and that's the thing too, like, Falk would still bring up, like, Magic getting his 25 years, 25 million, because it was like not recognizing that the money was changing so fast. You know, back then it's like, if you signed a big deal within like 2 years, you were basically getting ripped off.
Before we continue with Two Riders Slinging Yang, a quick word from our sponsor.
Hey, this is Jeff Perlman. I'm here with my son, Emmett, who turned 17 yesterday. Happy birthday, son.
Son? I'm not your son. I'm the bastard child of former Philadelphia Stars halfback Kelvin Bryant and former New Jersey Generals quarterback Bobby Scott. I was born in a 503 Sports Chicago Blitz blanket, and now I only wear the gilded threads of RoyalRetros.com. Son, I ain't your son.
But I wanted to give you this $100 gift card to RoyalRetros.com so you can buy more of the throwback merchandise you love.
Papa.
I remember when we lived together or when you were running Slam, there was a certain, every now and then you guys would get a sit down with Michael Jordan, and it would be like going to see the king of, the king of England. And oh my God, we have Jordan, and what are we going to ask him? Blah, blah, blah. What time do we have to be there? And then you would tell me about sitting down with Jordan, and yeah, he was cool. Blah, blah, blah. Those 7 minutes he gave, or those whatever. And sometimes, and sometimes you wouldn't. And I wonder, when you write a book about shoes, and obviously Jordan is such a heavy presence, what kind of efforts go into trying to get him to talk? And did you ever think he would talk?
You know what? I actually didn't. I actually figured from the start, I can draw on stuff that I've talked to him about before. I would rather try and get the peripherals than put a lot of energy into that. It was one of those things where Nike and Jordan ended up kind of not being super helpful with things as it was anyway. I had much better luck talking to former employees of places and former players, and even from those conversations with Jordan, I feel like when you're in it like that and you're the guy it's all being built around, I think their focus with Jordan with a lot of it was set it up so he can just go out there and play. Tinker Hatfield handled a lot of the inspiration type stuff, and obviously someone at Nike doing the technical stuff, and Mike just had to go out there and be the best basketball player in the world.
I'm not talking about basketball, strictly shoes, apparel. Is Jordan more closer to genius or accidental tourist?
I think it's a little bit of both. Obviously, I don't think Air Jordan works without Michael Jordan as the centerpiece of it. But I think it's also just it's a matter of changing times and changing norms. I always talk about Jordan as being he's the guy all the rappers looked up to, right? I mean, everyone would drop his name and verses and stuff. But Iverson was the guy who was of hip hop, who was a fan and wanted to be a rapper himself, and obviously also got name checked, but he would actually know who was doing it because he would listen to them. And I think Jordan was more on the outside. And I think even with the sneaker side of things, I think he was a little bit more of sort of an outsider who became the linchpin of it all. Jordan was kind of a suburban / country kid from North Carolina, and had this obviously incredible focus to do the things he did, and became the guy we all saw in The Last Dance. I think almost in a sense, Air Jordan was something that happened, not in spite of him, I would never say that, but around him. You look at the early Spike and Mike commercials, and Spike Lee did all the talking. Jordan's primary thing was to wear the shoe and do incredible things in it. You talk to even guys doing things later, and it's you built up this mythology, and it was about what he did on the court.
In all your years of covering basketball, shoes, the game, etc., what's your best confrontation you've ever had with either a player or a coach or an administrator? What is the maddest someone has been at you?
Ooh, early on when I was at Slam, I went to cover a UNC game, and I grew up a UNC fan in part because of Jordan. And we had had Slam t-shirts printed up. It was a totally new thing. We had this artist who submitted something, and they were wild cool. They're one of the best pieces of merch I remember us having ever. And, I go up there. It was in Massachusetts because it was the Hall of Fame game. It was Arizona against Carolina. And it was the year Arizona went on to win the title with Bibby and Miles Simon and those guys. Talking to the guys from Carolina, and Carolina was still a pretty strict old school program. Dean Smith, legend, but also came up in the 60s, wouldn't let freshmen talk until they played their first game. So I couldn't talk to Ed Cota. But I went up there with a bunch of t-shirts too. And at one point I'm giving shirts to guys, and they're psyched on it. Whatever. They know what Slam is there. And I forget whether it was the SID or someone like that pulled me aside and is yo, you can't do that. You're going to get us in trouble with the NCAA. And I was kind of mortified because it's oh my God, I'm going to get my favorite college team put on probation.
That would have been amazing if your legacy in sports media was not sneakers or Slam, but getting UNC banned from tournament play.
getting Dean Smith mad at me, which would have been like mortifying forever. Another good one, and this isn't about a player or a coach getting mad at me, but I remember one time going to, it was Knicks Celtics, I believe. You remember the game when Milt Palacio hit the shot from backcourt to beat the Nets?
I'm impressed with the Milt Palacio reference. So,
this was late 90s. So the Nets are playing the Celtics. They're up one, maybe up two, with hardly any time left on the clock. They're inbounding from the sideline. And basically, the only way they could lose this game is if they inbound into their own backcourt, lose the ball, and the guy hits a three. And that's exactly what happened. I think it was Lucius Harris throwing the inbounds pass. Palacio knocks it away, throws a stumbling shot up at the basket. It goes in, time expires, game over. And literally, like, I have never seen a team so devastated in my life. Like, the Nets were having a bad run at the time. This seemed to be the game that would break it. And like, they lose the game in literally the only way they could have potentially lost the game. My distinct memory is like that. And Lucius Harris taking his mouthpiece out and throwing it further than I've probably seen anyone throw anything ever. Whoever caught that at Continental Airlines Arena, I hope you still have it. I hope it's like on a plaque in your den. I was giving a print of a photo to someone in the Celtics locker room. And it was someone like Milt Palacio, who was like barely hanging on, right? Like just a fringe player. And someone in PR pulls me aside and is like, you can't be getting autographs in the locker room. I was like, okay, first of all, I've been going to games for years and I've never asked for an autograph. Second of all, like, do you think if I'm going to risk Slam's credentials forever, I'm going to be asking like a fringe player for an autograph? Like, no, I'm going to be going to like Paul Pierce or Twan or like, you know, someone. It was just so unbelievable to me that like, and it's kind of funny given all this Arcia stuff that went on with the Braves where it's like unprofessionalism in a locker room or whatever. Like, how are you even being serious about this? Like, I just remember being so, I was mad about it. You know, other than that, it's kind of funny. Like, I feel like looking back, like most players and coaches were generally pretty good. I didn't have a John Rocker moment. You know, I remember once, like, I was writing a story about Kobe. I wanted to ask Popovich about him because the Spurs were in town. And like, I didn't dare ask during the actual scrum because I didn't want to mess with the beat writer's time. People start clearing out and eventually it's like me, him, and somebody else. And I'm just like, oh my God, like I've seen him like react to open-ended questions. And like, do I really want to do this? And I'm like, all right, I got to do it. And I ask him this like kind of open-ended question about what makes Kobe so good. And like, he just gives me this incredible answer. He was so great. I guess there've been other times like that. The times that make you like happy to be doing this job.
August 2nd, 2021, Milt Palacio hired as an assistant coach by the Portland Trailblazers. However, 2 months later, placed on administrative leave while he was indicted with a group of former NBA players who had allegedly committed insurance fraud.
Oh, Milt, what are you doing, baby?
So Milt, a little more famous than you thought. I feel like there's an 80% chance you told that story just because you wanted to name drop Lucius Harris. And I 100% respect that.
Forever love Lucius Harris. My biggest memory of him is always like, I think he was coming back from injury or something. So he would always ride the exercise bike in the tunnel at Continental Airlines Arena. Now kids don't even know what Continental Airlines Arena is or that the Nets ever played in New Jersey.
Well, Russ, in the name of Yank Adare, in the name of Tony Delk, in the name of Keith Van Horn, and in the name of the late, great Dwayne Tsintsis, I appreciate you. I appreciate you doing this. I think the book is not only great, but freaking beautiful. I've never read a book that is this visually appealing. It's just my son picked it up and he's like, man, that's a good looking book. And I was like, it is a good looking book. I know it's a torturous process writing a book, but you came through with this freaking really beautiful, beautiful product and ode to sneakers. So big, big props to you.
Thank you. And definitely a big shout out to the Workman design people who did a fantastic job with it. It's also got some heft to it. We went around the day of the release to a bunch of courts in the city and like carrying those in tote bags. Like it's kind of a brolic book. If you're paying for it by the pound, like you're not doing too bad.
But Russ, big ups. Congratulations.
Thank you, Jeff. Always appreciate it.
I want to thank today's guest, Russ Bankston, for joining me on Two Riders Singing Yang. You can follow Russ on Instagram, @RussBankston, and buy A History of Basketball on 15 Sneakers, wherever books are sold. If you have a chance and enjoy Two Riders Singing Yang, please go to the vehicle of your choice and leave a nice review. I'd be really appreciative. Music is by the sizzling MC Wet Owl. Thanks again for joining me, and remember, keep riding.